Airing on Asheville FM, 103.3 LPFM in Asheville, this is The Final Straw Radio, a weekly anarchist and anti-authoritarian broadcast and podcast emanating out of occupied Chalagi land in southern Appalachia. We bring you voices and perspectives from projects and struggles all around the world, and you can find our archives, transcripts, ways to follow us and support us at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org. This week, the show has two segments. First up, a brief interview with M, an organizer of the first Pittsburgh Anarchist Book Fair, happening October 24th through 26th across a few venues in the Steel City. Check out our show notes for links to learn more and ways to support. And then you'll hear an interview that I conducted with Anarko, a member of Black Book Distro Collective out of Kathmandu, Nepal, about the context and aftermath of the September 2025 Gen Z anti-corruption protests that ousted the Prime Minister, released prisoners, and left the Parliament in smoldering ruins. Because we don't follow a strict chronology of events, we're including a bunch of articles linked in our show notes for further study, including one that we worked heavily off of for this interview between Black Book Distro and Crime Think.
We're here talking to M about the upcoming Anarchist Book Fair in Pittsburgh. M, can you introduce yourself to listeners, share any pronouns, affiliations, and anything else that might be relevant to the conversation?
Yeah, my name is M. I use they, them pronouns, and I do criminal legal organizing in Pittsburgh since about 2018. And I work on anti-repression projects primarily, including our abolitionist community bail fund, bucket bail fund, and related anti-repression projects.
Thank you so much. Can you give listeners some general impressions of Pittsburgh and maybe the surrounding areas with regard to organizing? It sounds like you have some experience. For example, have you found it to be welcoming and embodying a diversity of demographics and disciplines from an organizing standpoint?
Yeah, I ran this by the friends with whom I'm organizing this, Ben, Nothing, and Sean, and we kind of all had similar responses where I think Pittsburgh is a very special city with many, many incredible people and projects. I found it difficult in some ways with cliquishness and insularity that I think is not specific to our city, and that kind of, you know, I think we see across like big tent anarchism generally. But what's specific about Pittsburgh, I think, is the repression that the city has been under, especially in the last couple years, is I think especially high. And this fear of repression and combination with, you know, the concept of security culture have made it hard maybe for people who are newer to organizing, especially ones who might not share demographics or subcultures with some of the scenes here in our city, to know how to get more involved and where to start. So we have seen, you know, some vulnerability to folks getting sucked into authoritarian tendencies and projects or more extractive and exploitative electoral projects, nonprofits, things like that.
Many such cases. It sounds like that's sort of the impetus for this book fair. So can you maybe give us some background on how this event came to be and maybe talk about if it's the first book fair you're organizing and what that experience has been like?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's pretty cool because the four of us, I think, independently have wanted to make a book fair happen. And it kind of came up organically in the last half year or so. Nothing and I have been to a fair number of book fairs, Bashback, things like this. And Sean and, you know, kind of, and I were talking about it also earlier this year. Ben kind of independently was talking about it with a friend from his milieu. And as far as we know, there hasn't been an anarchist book fair in Pittsburgh, and we've been so lucky to kind of go to ACAB and Florida Abolitionist Gathering, Earth First, things like this over the years, and hoping that there's kind of a template in place for book fairs moving forward and in our part of the country.
So are you sort of designing it based on the best of what you've seen from all those previous experiences you've had?
Yeah, I would say that there's not really a template we're working from other events that we've been to exactly, but each of us have organized a lot of both cultural and political events in Pittsburgh, ranging from DIY shows to raves to talks at, you know, our info shop and workshops, and drawing on that experience as well as what we've seen of some of these book fairs and FAG and Bashback and and Earth First and whatnot. And we also want to give a special shout out to ACAB and FAG organizers just for sharing their wisdom with us and those experiences in particular the last year.
Excellent. Thank you so much. When you do something like this, I would imagine that there are kind of like twin efforts going. You have the programming aspect and then the security aspect of it. Is that about right?
That's very right, yeah. Safety has been a large component of the planning.
How do you navigate that?
Yeah, so navigating safety. Pittsburgh has been on the receiving end of some fascist activity in pretty specific ways the last year and a half. And I think that maybe we can talk about that more later in this as to like why we care about folk safety and both accessibility, safety, and kind of also this being a public event where anyone can kind of come to.
Sure.
So the way that we've kind of broken down safety was like first accessibility and just kind of thinking about like COVID mitigation, also like just security practices around masking and encouraging that and requiring that, and separately just being serious about thinking about medicing and safety as kind of related but separate buckets for each of the venues that we'll be working at. Yeah.
Have you had any issues as far as the venues that you're working with regard to accessibility, anything along those lines?
Yeah. So I think that, you know, no space is perfectly accessible, but the venues that we've selected, we're going to do masking required, do you have wheelchair access? We're hoping that folks will reach out for additional access needs where we can accommodate that to the extent that we're able. And the venues we selected were ones that are kind of known quantities that allow for, you know, like have an ADA bathroom and this sort of thing.
It sounds like there are multiple sites. Are they near to each other?
Yes, they're all right next to each other. Excellent. With the exception of one is a little further away, but all are walking distance. Three are kind of within 1 to 3 minutes of each other, and another is just a few minutes walk away.
Great. So can you talk a little bit about the response from tablers and vendors and maybe offer any kind of a preview of who you expect to be there?
Yeah. So we've had a really incredible response from speakers, panels, workshops, and tablers and vendors. It's hard to pick. I don't know if I feel like some of the sessions would be like just good to lift up on like Friday. We'll be having Rojava Solidarity Committee, a photography show, and a talk about a recent solidarity visit to Rojava. On Saturday, we're going to have a report back from Crystal and Pepe's support team and a status on how they are doing. We will have Vicky Osterweil and Shelly Branson on anarchist culture and social war on Saturday.
Awesome.
There'll be like an anti-fascist bird society walk that was really popular when we had a kind of a festival of resistance earlier this year. And on Sunday, we'll be having some folks join us remotely, like Peter Gelderloos and Tom Nomad will be in person.
Awesome.
Cindy Crabb will be talking about a lot of her work and oral history of the San Francisco dyke scene and so much more.
Not to put you on the spot, but what are you the most excited about?
Oh, God. So we were so lucky that, you know, kind of folks organically reached out to us and we were reaching out to folks. I honestly, you know, my schedule's cleared. I'll do as much of this as I can. I'm Nothing and I are putting together a rave on Saturday night with some friends that we hope will be a joyful, wild, sweet time. We've had like a pretty robust and exciting renegade rave scene in Pittsburgh recently that a lot of other folks can speak to and kind of ask questions about in other contexts. But Saturday night there'll be a rave and we'll have a closing fire on Sunday night for all of our tired minds and bodies to come together and hopefully firm up the connections made over the weekend.
Do you have any plans to record and or share any of the panels or presentations?
Yeah, so of the folks who are joining remotely, which maybe it's worth just kind of sharing a little bit about, we have folks from Serbia joining us about the Serbian kind of ongoing protests and increasing militancy that they're seeing over there remotely, and rituals for anti-fascist resistance with AMI. Like folks who are joining remotely, I'm hoping that we'll be able to record audio of those sessions. and we'll see about sharing them if the organizers are up to it. But I think for the live sessions that are not hybrid, we'll probably stick to in person. We'd be so thrilled if people wanted to do report backs and communiques about them. But when we do hybrid, we'll do our best to record audio and see if we can share that out into the world subsequently.
Great. Who do you want there? I guess I should ask. Will the event be family friendly? Is it adults only? How's it going to work?
Yeah, hoping that it's family friendly. We're coordinating childcare for the weekend, both Friday night as well as Saturday and Sunday, starting at 10 in the morning. We'd love it if folks who are bringing children could shoot us an email just with the age of their kids, so we can kind of gear the childcare a little bit towards age-appropriate activities. All of the sessions that we have really feel kind of family friendly and appropriate for anyone who's interested in anarchism.
Where can listeners who might be interested in attending or seeing what's going on find more information about the event?
So you can email us. We have an Instagram. We have a Facebook event, and we'll have flyers in person here in Pittsburgh throughout the city that folks can, hit us up for. And yeah, I think in general also just would really love if people have other ideas as to where we should share it. Please do get in touch. And yeah, just hoping to reignite us all falling in love with anarchism again and for the first time and over again. And hoping for folks who've been here for a long time feeling that spark reignited.
That's awesome. And I'm not sure if we covered it, but the dates and the times again?
October 24th to 26th. That's a Friday through Sunday. It'll start around 5 p.m. at two of the venues that we've booked. And then Saturday starting at 10:30 a.m. And events will be running until 9 p.m. on both Saturday and Sunday. And the rave will be starting pretty late on Saturday night. And Sunday night, we will have the closing fire after the last session is over.
Awesome. Well, that about covers it, I think. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me.
Thank you so much.
If you want to support The Final Straw Radio, you can subscribe to our podcast via various streaming platforms, follow, rate, and share our materials online, and learn more at tfsr.media. And if you'd like to fund our transcription work that allows for easier translation, more accessibility of content, and the zines that we produce for each interview, consider picking up some merch from us or making a one-time or recurring donation via PayPal, Stripe, Venmo, or LibrePay. Or joining our Patreon to access early release content and other goodies via the links that you can find at tfsr.media/support. Finally, if you'd like to hear us on your local radio station, visit tfsr.media/radio to find more info or reach out to us for some help. Thanks for listening.
a lot of my friends know me by Anarko, and I am based in Kathmandu, Nepal, and grew up in Kathmandu, and have been here trying to make some mess since some time.
So. Well, somebody has to make a mess, right?
Yeah.
All right. And could you talk a bit about Black Book Distro and also about your impression of anarchist history in Nepal and what anarchist organizing looks like these days?
So me and my friends, we started Black Book around 2020, when the first lockdown ended and before the second started. It was kind of like around that time we started it. And since the beginning, our focus was to make it a collective and a library where we can do talks, workshops, meetings, organizing, planning, those sort of thing. So yeah, in the beginning, it was quite small because before there was another anarchist library. It still is here, but it's not active because the person who was running it has moved to UK. So that the older InfoSop, we just called it InfoSop. There was InfoSop and it was in different part of the town. So we started it in our side. And talking about anarchist history in Nepal is not that long. It's also from 1990s, when the first punk bands started. Before that, it's mostly communist history, I would say, because we haven't found any written documents or anything before that. We're pretty sure there were some anarchists, but we don't have any proof. So we just say it started from the 90s with the punk movement, because most of the punk movement came from UK, children's of British Gorkha Army who went to UK to study or live there, got influenced by punk music and anarchism. And when they came back to Nepal, they spread it around here also. And what was the last question on it?
Up until this uprising, what are anarchist organizing or projects you've seen around Kathmandu or around Nepal?
It's only mostly based in Kathmandu, actually, anarchist projects. There are anarchists in other towns or cities of Nepal as well, but they don't have a physical space. So they only do things when there are gigs and stuff. So actual with solid space and organizing is based in Kathmandu. And before the protest, anarchists were mostly involved in art, music, radical education. Let's say we were doing radical anti-school, which was a six-month project where every Saturday, different topic, different speakers. We used to do it in the oldest university in Nepal, which is in Kathmandu. The university didn't knew what we were actually doing. But because we had connection with some communist friends there who had influence, they just got us the permission. So yeah, we were organizing anarchist lectures in the university, which was funny. Other than that, it's mostly intellectuals, actually, because people still don't know what anarchism is. There are people who call themselves anarchists, but they usually don't have any concrete idea. If somebody asks them, okay, so what's anarchism? They'll be no God, no master, and then finished kind of situation. So we're mostly focused on more radical literature. Oh, yeah. Just now, like, people are actually starting to get more familiar with anarchist literature and history and things. It's slowly there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it seems like, I mean, to me, as someone who's been involved in anarchism for a few decades, that where you don't feel that there's very much influence, the education and the getting people thinking about anarchistic responses to problems, figuring out what their desires are, figuring out how they can relate to the people that they're going to organize with and what goals they want to reach, those sort of like very basic introductory things feel like an important thing. You build the movement by people figuring out what they want.
True. Like, that was one of a big issue, because it kind of became like an intellectual leftist bubble situation where anarchists think like, the people will not understand this, or like they don't care. So they kind of try to stop communicating with the mass. I think that happens everywhere, but in here too, it took some a lot of arguments and debates for Black Book to run like it does, because there were friends who were like, we should not do all these kind of things. Like, there is no point like trying to like make people understand anarchism. We'll just be like putting ourselves at risk and those kind of thing. And there were friends who were like, we should do this. What are we going to do with InfoSub being always underground sort of situation? So, yeah, I agree with your thing, because, yeah, I also have been like in this movement for like a decade and a little bit more now, and a lot of things have improved. Actually, I'm quite happy regarding Nepal in like the amount of interest that has increased. But yeah, it's mostly always intellectual bubble. People do need to go and communicate with the mass.
Yeah. And that's interesting. When you were saying about with the history where it feels like you couldn't find documentation, but you felt like probably it was there. I feel like in a lot of parts of the world, I mean, here as well, it's been relatively hard, like uncovering some of the history at times, but a lot of stuff just got subsumed under Marxism, or they, like the Marxists, like either by the powers in this country, you know, government would say, they're all communists, and ignore the differences between and where there were anarchists, oftentimes they would get purged out of parties or whatever, or pushed to the sidelines as being, just trouble as opposed to actually having ideas. I don't know if that's a similar thing there, because there has been such a strong history of Marxist, Leninist, and Maoist organizing, right?
One of the main reason we say like they're, we're anarchists, but we don't have any proof, is because Nepali radical movement is kind of started together with Indian independence struggle also. When India was fighting for its independence, there were a lot of Nepali radicals who were exiled from Nepal who were there. And the Nepali radicals were involved in the independence struggle also for India. That's why Nepal and India has kind of like a very mixed up political situation always, because since that time is always mixed up. And as India also had anarchists those time, like MPT Acharya and Hardayal, those guys were openly calling themselves anarchists and writing books and articles going around. And Indian communists were also aware of anarchists, and like even, yeah, it has been mentioned in a lot of places. So I'm pretty sure like somebody got inspired by anarchism, some of the Nepali radicals there. So But yeah, either they didn't write anything, or even if they wrote something, it's lost.
So on September 8th, the Nepalese state faced anti-corruption protests so large that within 35 hours, Prime Minister Khadga Prasad Oli of the Communist Party of Nepal, Unified Marxist-Leninist, fled office. These protests, labeled Gen Z protests, as the median age in Nepal is 25 years old, seems sparked by an attempt to shut down social media that the government attempted to shut down social media following the trending of commentary about corruption and nepotism being rife in the country. Can you talk about the economic and social conditions prior to the protests and who was out on the streets protesting?
Now on the 8th and 9th, it was called a Gen Z movement, and yes, a lot of Gen Zs were involved, but it was Gen Z and millennials, actually, because a lot of our friends were also there. I was there, like, we were looking around, and it was not just Gen Zs, it was millennials there also, and even older folks there were also involved. And it was, they were just Gen Zs going there. It was just labeled Gen Z because that generation started saying we need to protest on this day, and even their group name was Gen Z, so that's why it ended up being called Gen Z. And I'm not sure about like the 35 hour mark, because it's a conflicting argument, because on the 8th the protest was not to topple the government. The youth were there. It was more than social media ban. It was against corruption, actually. Social media ban just ignited the anger of people. Because at least if there was social media, people were distracted. And suddenly, nothing is working, and people don't know how to use VPN and things. People suddenly had time to think and get angry, I guess. No longer Instagram reels and Facebook reels for a bit. But very fast, within a couple of hours, everybody had downloaded VPNs. So the first day, I would not say that was not a protest to topple the government. It was supposed to be a peaceful protest. Police killed a lot of people. And then the second day was to topple the government. People were so mad. They were okay, we're going to burn everything down. So in my perspective, it didn't even took 8 hours to topple the government, because protests started different part of the country by 8 or 9 in the morning, and then by 2 or 3 the prime minister had resigned, the military had and the police had surrendered, and people burned everything down. So if you look at both of the protests, we can say 35 hours or something, but actual time needed to topple the government was 8 hours or something.
Okay, that's a good point. But can you talk about what the timing of starting the bookstore in 2020? It makes a lot of sense that people who are in lockdown during the beginning of the COVID pandemic would be feeling isolation and be thinking about what projects can we build to bring people together in the ways that we want. But that also was coming just, within a year of the giant 2019 anti-corruption protests that people were involved with. I wonder if you could sort of talk about what complaints of corruption people have, this hashtag NepoBaby, who are they talking about? How does class structure work? How does political power work in Nepal? And what brought people to take extra parliamentary action in the streets in order to, at first protest and then secondly, after all the killing, take down the government?
Most of the youths, like the actual Gen Z generation, started getting sort of politically aware from the Enough is Enough protest during lockdown, where government was not doing anything for the people. So people were basically like starving in their houses. So then like a lot of youths went out and started protesting. It was supposed to be peaceful. And they were even like, the protest was so peaceful that they were even like maintaining the distance of 2 meters. So like the youths were like standing in the street, like 2 meter distance between them, and just holding posters and things. But then typical police just started throwing tear gas and things, became violent, and nobody died during that time. But that was kind of like a starting point for a lot of Gen Zs. Because now, like when I'm talking with the younger folks who are more like involved in protests or like the political issues, for many of them, like lockdown and enough is enough was the starting point. And with the Nepo baby thing, it's just Nepali frustration, you know, because most of the Nepali, they have to go and work in Dubai and Saudi and Malaysia and end up dying there a lot of time just to make that stupid stadium for the World Cup. Like nearly 5,000 Nepali workers died during the whole process. And Nepali government does nothing about it. Even Nepali people don't know about it, actually. Like, it's not that much talked about in media. People know, like, workers are coming back on boxes, a lot of them. But my friends were researching on how many people died, Nepalese, and then it was like 5,000 something, which is just ridiculous. And then, so those are the contrast. You know? Most of the youth, they end up going working on those harsh conditions. Those who have money end up going to Europe, US, Australia. And then there are the children of the politicians who don't have to work. Some of them go and study in Harvard, those places, like posting their Louis Vuitton and like their fancy cars and all their travels and hashtag peace love in their posts and things. And people were just quite frustrated. And so Nepali Gen Z is quite fast picked that trend. I think it started in Philippines, I think, Nepo baby trend. And Nepali also started it. And then it was kind of, people just suppose it that because of the Nepo baby trend, where people were specifically targeting politicians and their children, that social media ban happened. So yeah, Nepo baby kind of started it, actually. And with the social media ban, people got so frustrated, not because they can't use Facebook, but just seeing like how much the government doesn't care about the people and all the corruption. And when people talk about it, and they ban the social media sort of issue. And then yeah, the Gen Zs were kind of, the group was called Gen Z. And I think most of the people of that, one of the main organizing, in the beginning, the main piece, I think most of them are Gen Z also, but maybe not all of them. And it was supposed to be peaceful, but it gathered so much crowd that it was not possible. We kind of knew it that there will be riot. For sure, when like 10,000-20,000 people gather in the street, then I don't believe that it would be peaceful. And especially if they're trying to reach the parliament, Yeah,
and once the police start, I mean, a lot of riots anyway are reactions to police overreactions and like fear-based increases in the amount of violence that they use against a crowd. That's a good way to get a crowd to riot.
But it's quite intense, though, because Nepal police haven't killed people like that before. Like, yes, during the civil war, yeah, there was actual war, so and that time people were killed. But after that, like, Nepal has seen like a lot of revolutions. So even when like toppling the monarchy, the death count was, I don't know, 12 something. Quite confused. It was 75 now, the death count.
With what you were talking about with people having to go abroad for work, so I guess that was one thing that I was wondering about, is because these articles that I've read have talked about the, and it makes sense if the majority of, like, you know, the majority of people in the streets tend to be younger because they're affected by economic insecurity or lack of opportunity. And then if people are having, because of that economic, like, lack of opportunity, having to go abroad for dangerous jobs that don't pay very well, maybe they move abroad, you know, start communities there, families, what have you, or maybe they die, as you were describing with the football stadium construction. And then you mentioned the Civil War too. Are these contributing factors to why the average age in Nepal is so young?
Yes and no. Also, I'm not sure exactly why it's like that, but a lot of youths are not in Nepal. Like, the majority. Nepal brain drain is like 70% or something. 70% of the educated youths are not here. So the Gen Zs were actually participating are either jobless or have some not that good job, or we're trying to go abroad. So a lot of people who died during the protest, nearly all of them were planning to go abroad.
So there were a number, starting on the 9th, according to what I was reading, there were a number of arsons against the houses of current and former politicians from a number of different political parties. Does this represent an observable anti-political strain in the protests, or does this seem to be a concerted act of one faction or another?
It's a mix of both. There was a lot of public anger also. So people in Nepal, like, they are like, they hate the government, and there was always this subconscious thing in their mind, because anytime when like people are angry with politics, it has been many years, people used to say like, we should burn down the parliament. That was a very common thing in Nepal, or like, go and burn down the politician houses. But it was always in the imagination before. But on the 9th, it actually came out, because a lot of people who died in the first day were actually students also. Students in school uniform, like shot in the head or in the chest, and a lot of millennials there. So, like, especially the school kids dying in school uniform, just like, people were like, okay, now let's go burn it down. But that race was also sabotaged by political factions also. They were just waiting for something like that to happen. So when the Supreme Court got burned down, like, we're pretty sure it was done by political factions to get rid of evidence that could be used against them. And also, like, a lot of prison breaks also. In one of the prison breaks, the head of one of the political party person was there, Robi Lamichane. And that prison break was definitely organized to break him free. And but he came out and then tried to get back into politics, said that the police there actually let him out, created fake paper, but people found out it was fake, and like all the country was like, go back to prison. So he again went back to prison. And there were things like that, like Supreme Court, the prisons, and other ministries, for sure. So it's a mix of both. Like, but it was, so let's say like 80% was public anger. Because we went around all of Kathmandu, like, and it was just normal people, like, just going and, like, burning down police stations and burning down politician houses or the parliament or, like, those countless ministries. And people were just singing and chanting and, like, clapping, watching everything burn down. It was, like, euphoric. So it's mixed.
Yeah, I bet it was euphoric, especially if for years people were just like, you know, we should really get rid of that thing. Yeah. My impression from the Crime Think interview that some members of Black Book did is that there are a variety of competing ideas among the protesters, so that alliances can rise in the moment that could recede or reverse as groups are able to integrate into state structures. Can you talk about some of the different factions among the opposition or among the protests and what this is like?
So right now, like, all the three major parties have gotten a really nice blow in their face. So their headquarters and everything got burned. So now they're like really quiet, just releasing statements online, no protests, nothing, because people have completely lost trust on like all the three major parties, but they still have a lot of influence because they have been here in control for like 40 years, 50 years now. So they're just waiting to come back, waiting for the right time. So the three political parties might work together for something, but then there is the royalists are there also, who the extreme ones want monarchy back, which is not gonna happen, but they keep shouting about it. But there is a faction that says make Nepal Hindu again, so no longer secularism, and that might be more possible, which is very sketch for us because that's completely like Indian motif, you know, like from the BJP and the...
Yeah, is that the Rashtriya Prajatantra Party, the RPP, kind of like related to the, I think, the RSS in India?
Yeah. So they're definitely funded by BJP and those guys. And so there's the old parties, the royalist faction, and now different groups are starting to form. So like, now different people are trying to make political parties, and then there is like the actual left, as we call it in Nepal, because like the communist parties are not left anymore. So whatever is left of the actual left, we are just talking and saying like, let's not touch secularism, federalism. We can amend the constitution, and it's okay to create a new party, but we can't still remain as stupid as before, where like Nepali people are quite like too naive sometimes, you know, like they actually believe what the politicians say. So that's kind of like a very weird thing here. Thankfully now they are not. So there's like some activists who were involved in the protests. I think they're trying to make a party. So there's like three factions now. like the younger generation with some political agendas and aspirations are trying to form their own party. The royalists want their own thing. The old parties want to come back. So, yeah, those are the three things happening.
Yeah, I want to ask more about the communists. I guess what I'm wondering about is so there have been decades of insurgency related to various Leninist and Maoist communist parties. There was that civil war that you mentioned, and they've integrated into the national government. So I'm wondering, as an anarchist project, how is it to relate to a mostly younger population who, when they probably hear about anti-capitalists, they think of these corrupt, integrated, formerly leftist communist parties? How do leftist politics or the discourses around anti-capitalist alternatives, how does that work? What do you come up against with that?
Right now, like, leftist people are finding kind of like a hard time because of like what the old communist parties did. So right now, like, calling yourself communist in Nepal is, I mean, if someone is, so, but someone who understands politics, they will be like, ah, okay, he's calling himself a communist. And they'll be like, okay, fine, his own choice. But for a lot of people who don't understand what actual communist is and the communist that we have in the government, they think it's the same. So a lot of communists who actually want to do good are finding very hard time. But regarding anarchists, Nepali people don't know what anarchism is. They haven't heard about it, actually, a lot of them. So a lot of time is quite easy, actually. Because if we use the English term, you know, if we use the literal translation of anarchism, it just kind of translates to chaos or something. So we don't use the Nepali translation on it. We just call it anarchism. And people who already have biasness and knows about anarchism, they try to fight with us verbally, saying like, ah, you guys are trying to like ruin the country even more. Nepal doesn't need radical left politics. Look what it's doing to US, blah, 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 liberal talks. But other than that, Nepali people are very curious about anarchism, which is good for us because Nepal never had an anarchist movement before. So it's completely new for most of Nepali people. Unlike Europe, where like as soon as you say anarchist or in US, they imagine someone like trying to throw a bomb or something. But here it's just like they have no image of an anarchist. So whatever image that we can make will be the image of anarchists in Nepal. So we're in good point, actually.
Is the anarchism that you see people talking about or engaging with, or spaces like Your Space or the Info Shop before, are they pretty heavy with punk subculture? Or is that just a part of the history and a part of the wider culture? Like, how central is punk to anarchism there?
Before, it was like heavily influenced and interconnected with punk culture, because nearly all the anarchists were punks and they have their own bands and they go around doing gigs. But during the gig, there's a stall in the back with anarchist literature. So I used to stay behind with all the books and merch and like the nerdy guy behind who loves punk music, but is more focused on anarchism sort of things. So, but that is kind of like gone now. Now, like a lot of punks gig, they don't put anarchist literature behind, but they do come for workshops and talks and things. And now is more than punks, it's just everyday people just showing up, curious people. So before it was more punk, and now it's very less punk and just everyday people.
I guess moving back to the question that I had before about the communists. Okay, so coming from the US where I am, I can see clearly that, you know, the Liberal Party because we're a two-party system effectively in this country, except for maybe on some local political levels, you can see how the two parties work in tandem to present oppositions at various points. And that's not to say they have the same policies all the time